Mr. Rhodes, greetings. Of course, we know you haven't changed a bit since Steve and I met you in 1972. Well, we're delighted to have you with us, Mr. Rhodes. Greetings. Hope you're staying warm up there in Michigan. Got cold last night here, too. What is it, about 40 or something like that? 40 below in Michigan, 40 here, so... I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. 31 words, the pledge of allegiance to the United States of America. Do they still do that in schools? We have some school-age kids. Still do that? Do that in school every day? We did it every day. They never did actually explain what the Pledge of Allegiance means. And I'm sure that most of us are in the same kind of generation. We all went to school and all recited the Pledge of Allegiance. And we also, up until I think it was 1964, we also recited the Lord's Prayer before school every day. Right, as the school bell rang at 8 o'clock or whenever we began, we did the Pledge of Allegiance and the Lord's Prayer, and then Madeline Murray O'Hare came along and had a Supreme Court decision that changed all of that. So the Pledge of Allegiance is really a pledge. You'll pardon my artistic license here. It's really a pledge to an ancient patriarch of the Bible. And I would submit to you an ancient patriarch of the United States of America. Pledging allegiance to the flag of the United States is a recognition of a unique nation, not a democracy. People say, I don't like democracies. It's not a democracy that we live in, although there are democratic principles. We live in a republic. It's one nation, as the pledge says, indivisible. The Pledge of Allegiance was written on the 400th anniversary of the discovery of America by Columbus. In 1892, this pledge was written, and it was issued to all schools. It wasn't in its current form, but it captured the same ideals. And it was a pledge not just to the flag and not just to the sovereigns of the United States of America, but it was to an ideal. The United States of America has not been perfect by any means through its 240 years or so of history. The one nation indivisible referred to the outcome just 27 years earlier of the Civil War. And liberty and justice for all express the ideals of the Declaration of Independence. The words originally read, my flag, and they were replaced by the flag of the United States as there was massive immigration after that time to the United States. And the individuals who wrote those original words didn't want individuals who immigrated to the United States, like even my parents, in my dad in 1921, to be looking back to the flag of their own country's origin, like to Germany or to Italy or to the United Kingdom. The flag of the United States then was added in 1923. They just didn't want those born in other countries who immigrated to the United States to finally look back and remember their former flag that they might have allegiance to. A year later, of America was added after United States. Congress first recognized the Pledge of Allegiance in June 22, 1942, and it was formally included in the U.S. Flag Code. The official name, the Pledge of Allegiance, was adopted in 1945, and the last day in the language came on Flag Day, 1954, when Congress passed a law that added the words under God after one nation. Pretty short, but very, very meaningful, 31 words. It's the essence of what America was intended to be, is captured in many other important documents like the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, but it captures the spirit of one man as well. The Pledge of Allegiance affirms the values and the freedoms that the American flag represents. I submit to you that no other nation on the face of the earth can claim an ancient biblical patriarch as the source of their inspiration. I'm taking some license here. It's not a part of our teaching in the history of America in our schools. Very few people know of this individual because they're not as familiar with the Bible as you are. He isn't mentioned in early American history, but had he lived during those days, I'm sure he'd have gotten along very well with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, all the other signers of the Declaration of Independence. The Bible takes individuals who have lived, and especially this individual, and personifies through history an entire group of people, and God calls them by that name. He calls you by that name. If you live in the United States of America, you carry that name. Even no matter where you were, if you emigrated to the United States, you're under that flag, aren't you? You're dedicated to the loyalty of that flag and what it means and its nation. In history and in prophecy, this individual is mentioned as one of the greatest patriarchs of the Bible, and I think of the United States as well. That individual's name is Jacob. Jacob, one of the great American patriarchs, and one of the great biblical patriarchs. Where did this nation? I'm going to concentrate on this nation, although we could have Mr. Rhodes come sometime and speak about the United Kingdom, because it also applies. So I'm not excluding, and I'll have a few mentions of the United Kingdom today in this message. But where did this nation, the United States of America, come from? Where are we now in the prophecies pertaining to our ancient patriarch of the United States, Jacob, or Israel? Understanding Jacob is understanding the United States of America, and it also helps us to understand the British Commonwealth of Nations in history. But for today, I'm going to concentrate mostly on America. Now, the title is very, very dramatic, and, you know, sometimes I use dramatic titles just to get clicks when we put it up on the internet. Maybe I'll be like Mr. Tanner, not put my sermons up on the internet anymore. I don't know, whatever. But the title is The Death of Jacob. I'm going to cover this in three or four points today, so you can number your points. The first one is, let's start with our national origin that goes back way back beyond 1776. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25 and verse 21. Now, somebody without the familiarity that you have of the United States and British Commonwealth and prophecy would be admittedly totally lost if they didn't have the background of who the descendants of Jacob are. So my assumption is that virtually the entire audience and most people that will ever listen to this, if it's ever posted on the internet, will understand who these people are anciently, or who our people are anciently, and who the national origin of our people are. In the New King James Version of the Bible, the name Jacob appears 357 times. And do you know that every time the name Jacob appears in the Bible, it is specifically referring to one person, one individual, no one else in the Bible carries the name of Jacob, which I think of and by itself is an interesting thing, because other names are repeated throughout the Bible. But Jacob, mentioned 357 times in the Bible, always refers in one way or another back to him. The Jacob that is mentioned in Genesis chapter 25, and we'll begin in verse 21. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's read it here. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. This must have been one of the most difficult pregnancies ever, because not only was there morning sickness, but these two little guys were fighting each other inside the womb for a long time. And it was an incredible thing. But when the children struggled together within her, she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, and this was, as far as we know, Isaac was not told this information at that time, but it was revealed to Rebekah that two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So she had all of this advance news. So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, and he was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. And afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, or supplanter, or heel catcher, some translations bring out. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So they were older parents. They had to wait a long time for their initial kids. But obviously, as you can see, these were not identical twins. They were fraternal twins. And they were as opposite as you could get from one another. They were nothing like each other. And God had revealed to Rebekah, remember, that the younger would take the lead over his brother. So this knowledge undoubtedly shaped how these boys grew up and developed. There was conflict right from the beginning, even at birth, that continued until today with their respective descendants. In verse 27, we see some of the profound differences. The boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And some of the commentaries bring out that Jacob was not just lazy, not just because he wanted to stay in the tents, but he was a mild man, he was a learned man, he was a cultured man, and he was totally different than kind of the wild guy in the outdoors, hunter. Nothing wrong with being a hunter, nothing wrong with being an outdoorsman. But there were profound differences, and as we see in verse 28, the parents kind of played favorites with them. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, and Rebekah loved Jacob. So that happens from time to time, even in families in the Bible. Does happen. It's kind of an unfortunate consequence of two people that may not know as much as they should about raising kids. Maybe they should have known more, you know, since they were a little bit older than most parents are. But this is what happened, and it certainly had a hand in shaping the development of these two individuals. Now, would it have changed things later on in life? Probably not. But as interesting as it is that Isaac loved Esau more and loved him for certain reasons, for his game and the fact that he was an outdoorsman, in fact, it appears if you'll go back into the study, it looks as though Jacob took on some of the entrepreneurial tendencies of his father more so than Esau did. You go back a few chapters and you study the life of Isaac. And you see that, you know, kind of whatever he did, it seemed to multiply. And, you know, he was asked to leave certain areas because he just grew and his family grew so much and his herds grew so much that, you know, they wanted him to get away. He just kind of, it wasn't an accident that he was successful, and success of any kind is never really an accident. It's a matter of applying oneself and having determination and having a never give up spirit. And this is what embodied the life of Jacob. He had some bad qualities, but these two boys were diametrically different from one another. And the book of Hebrews shows that you have to go a little bit further into the narrative, because here are a couple of people's lives that are summed up in a couple of chapters or a few chapters in the Bible. There are a lot of chapters that are devoted to Jacob and his life and Esau as a brother. But look what Hebrews does in speaking about Esau. In Hebrews chapter 12, in verse 14, it's a good Christian living lesson for all of us at any time, because these kinds of things can happen to anybody. And it happened to Esau. There was a rage, there was an intense anger, and it became the driving, motivating force in his life. It is totally unchristian, but it is used as a spiritual example. His whole life, and actually if you want to take it all the way down through history, the lives of his descendants are great lessons as to how powerful an emotional attitude or outburst can affect individuals in your family line, all the way down through history in this case. In Hebrews chapter 12, it says in verse 14, pursue peace with all people. And that kind of goes against the grain of human nature. And maybe it's in some people's nature to be peaceful and mild and kind, in other people or not, but whatever happens in life, we are told to pursue peace as much as we can, and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. It is an absolute requisite for us from a spiritual standpoint, because there's not any human being that has ever lived that hasn't been wronged, that hasn't been hurt, that hasn't had their feelings hurt over something. Everybody shares this condition. It is the human condition. Some people overcome it. Some people don't. Esau did not, and he is given as an example to avoid, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Now, this gets into a real spiritual principle, because now I'm speaking to members of the church of God, members who have been wronged at times. Whether it was somebody didn't shake your hand and you got mad at him and, you know, you held it against him, as I've seen some people do for forever, or you were ignored, or you were ignored by someone that you thought shouldn't ignore you, or you felt like you were passed over. And this happens in the church. Been around a lot. I've seen these things happen. And it can lead to an intense spiritual problem. It's bad enough that it can be a physical problem, but there are going to be wrongs in this life. That is a known fact. How do you deal with it? How do you react to it is the main thing. You're going to have people double-cross you. You're going to have people stab you in the back, and it seems like their lives are just going to go on. But what do you do when it happens to you? Because this is all great. It's in theory. It's in a Bible. It's written here. It's for everybody else, right? Not me right now. But someday it'll come for you. Someday it will be at your doorstep, and a test of your Christianity and your ability to mobilize the power available to you from God will be the real test. So looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Oh, yeah. One person's example can affect somebody else, right? And then that person takes on kind of the anger and the injustice. There will be injustices. Can promise you that in life, in the church of God, no matter how, and some of them are real and some are imagined. It happens. You know, I'd like to just say, get over it. It's happened to every single one of us. It really has. How do you deal with it? The formula is given here. It says, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright, which just doesn't tell the whole story. You have to do a deep dive into this and examine what it is. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, but found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. What does it mean? He really didn't seek repentance in the right way. He never gave up that anger towards his brother. Oh, yeah, they had a reunion. I don't have time to cover all that. But it shows you how much Jacob knew about his brother, because his brother wanted to kill him. And he comforted himself with the idea, after his brother deliberately conspired with his mother to steal his inheritance, to absolutely take it. That's the way it came across to him. Jacob was opportunistic and sneaky and diabolical. All of those things are true. But the one comfort, and this is a sad way to live, the one comfort that Esau kept him going was revenge. I will kill him when Dad dies. That's a pretty sad way to leave. And that story is mentioned back in Genesis in 25, where he sells his inheritance because he's hungry. That's the way Esau was. The immediate need, the immediate satisfaction, the immediate gratification. It was just a character flaw and a problem. The confusing and confounding thing for many Americans today is they don't understand why people halfway across the world hate them. They didn't understand in 9/11, while there was jubilation in the streets of many of the capitals in the Middle East because the Twin Towers had been knocked down, the symbol of the financial strength of the United States. Americans, hopefully not you, Americans did not understand the relationship between these peoples and the peoples of Esau and Ishmael, which we'll get to in just a minute. How could people rejoice when something bad happens to, you know, people you don't really have any, you don't have any skin in the game with them? People don't understand that, because it goes back to this ancient enmity that was never really healed, never really sought after with the right kind of repentance. So you see one man going off in a direction of revenge and hate and anger because his little brother took advantage of him. And actually, he had himself to blame, but here again is human nature at work. We don't like to blame ourselves. It's somebody else's fault. Somebody has wronged me. I must get my justice. Let God fight our battles for us. That's the answer, and we know that. So Jacob is opportunistic. Esau valued only what he had right there at the moment. Technically, we don't know what the arrangements were. I mean, there's all kinds of Bible commentaries you can read, and you're just never going to come to a conclusion as to what it means here. What kind of arrangement? Would he get more as the older brother as an inheritance? The main lesson to take out of this is that he was jealous because he lost it all. He lost his entire inheritance to his brother. His brother kind of, you know, talked him out of it. Bargained for it. traded him something for it. And at the time, he thought, you know, I need that. Willie Nelson sold one of his greatest early songs for $50 because he needed the money. And he just, you know, later on, Willie Nelson had a much better attitude about selling the rights to that song, which other people made millions off of. Can't remember the name of the song. It was back in the 50s. But he said, at the time, I needed that $50. And he said, and I figured if I wrote one song, I could write a bunch more, and he has. So anyway, half the audience is lost. So I hate Willie Nelson. Okay, whatever. Chapter 27 of Genesis and verse 36, getting into the life of this Esau. Now, at this time, the national blessings have already been dispensed. We're bypassing the deception, the deceit, the very intricate plan of mama and son, favored son Jacob. And they pulled off this heist. It was one of the greatest heists in history until the one that happened just recently. But in verse 36, it says, Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, my inheritance, and now he's taken away my blessing. He said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? And then Isaac answered and said to him, indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do for you now, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me also, my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Very sad. Then Isaac, his father, answered, it's not really a blessing. It's not really a blessing being given here. It almost sounds like it. Behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth. Actually, what it means is, your dwelling shall be away from the fatness of the earth. Away from the dew of heaven from above, and by your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. And you can read the book of Obadiah for an update on what happens later on in the end of time and just before the time of Christ's return with this enmity coming to fruition with the people of Jacob and the people of Esau. But we shouldn't leave out the fact that as you read in the next few chapters, you'll find that Rebekah didn't like the fact that Esau had chosen wives from the people right around there. And so she said, these women, these wives here, these girls here are going to be the death of me. And so we need to send Jacob away. And also she was concerned that Esau was going to kill him because that word got out. And I'm sure that Esau bragged about it and told a few people, and his anger spread to others and maybe his allies. And so they got Jacob out of town. And they want him to go back to where her family was from. And as you know, he found his wife there. But it's interesting, the side move. Esau was he knew about this whole thing, you know, what mom and dad had decided to do. And so he wasn't going to give up on that blessing just yet. What did he do? Verse 6 of chapter 28, Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother. Well, he had some good qualities too. Opportunistic, sneaky, capitalizing on other people's weaknesses and failures, etc., etc. And he had gone to Padan Aram. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father, Isaac. So, look at this. On the surface, okay, that's a little bit odd. He goes to Ishmael's family, who was the rejected son, of course, of Hagar, the Egyptian, who is Hagar associated with Abraham. That's where the birthright blessings go back to. So I really believe this was a move on Esau's part to kind of reconnect the whole family, the broken ends of both families. Here we go. Esau, the rejected son, with one of the daughters of Ishmael, the rejected former son of Abraham. Very interesting. I think there's more to it than just what we read in verse 9. I believe it was an attempt on his part to work into either the good graces of his family or to somehow secure something. He didn't even know what he needed to secure. He didn't even know what Bible prophecy would hold. But the end result is that he mentions in verse 36 that we read in the previous chapter that he blames Jacob for a decision that he alone had made. Well, we know that, moving on, we know that the blessings did go to Jacob. It's obvious that God intended to give them to Jacob for the certain qualities that he had. And the hatred and the enmity continued. They kind of made up, but Jacob certainly understood the attitude of his brother. When they do finally meet again years later, he sends wave after wave of presents and flock and blessings to kind of mollify the temper that he knew his brother had. And they kind of made up as families at that time, but throughout history, we see a real enmity that is still there. Americans don't understand it, but at least it's still there. It's a part of our history. In chapter 28 and verse 12, we find now that as he's on his way to meet Laban and his family, God begins to work with him. He begins to intervene in his life. And as he's sleeping, he's dreaming this famous dream of angels going up and down to the throne of God from earth and up to the throne of God. God is intervening in his life. In verse 13, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, and the land on which you lie will give to you and your descendants. And also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That is huge. That is unbelievable as a promise from God to an individual. In verse 16, Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely I know that the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And that wasn't the only encounter that he had, but it led to something dynamic. It led to a relationship in which he says in verse 22, and this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. He understood tithing. Now, we're not told throughout the rest of the history of Jacob's physical life how that was imparted to God. But I'm left to assume that he must have made good on that promise that he made with God. So what are the tendencies of Jacob? Well, you can take these either way. You can take them positively or negatively. Opportunistic. He was inventive. He persevered, he had a cunning, he was a planner, he was purposeful, and he was forward-thinking. And in all of those things, you could say that that and more describes the American ideal and the Pledge of Allegiance that we took as little kids with our hands over our hearts, pledged our recognition of that ideal, that certain type of attitude. And when people come to this country, even if they're not, you know, from the lineage, so to speak, racially, of Jacob, when they're successful, it's because they take on those qualities. And those qualities are transferable to other people, no matter what your racial makeup might be. Hard work, determination, perseverance, overcoming, all of those things have worked in America. Independent thought, being independent, you know, thinking for yourself, reasoning, deducting. There's the story that I just don't have enough time to really get into, or I'll not even have time for points 2, 3, and 4. But there's the story of the argument that he gets into with his father-in-law. He gets into with Laban, you know. And so Jacob says, and you can read this into chapters, Jacob says, "All right, just let me pick out the colored ones, the spotted, the speckled ones. I'll take those. You have yours. Let's set the..." Laban said, "Okay, let's set a lot of distance between us." And so he does. And so you see this strange thing where he takes rods of poplar and almond and stripes them, takes the bark off, and what's he doing? And he sets them by the watering troughs and everything. You know, you could read 100 commentaries, and I don't think you're going to find the right answer as to what all that meant, because what happens afterwards is that the herds of Jacob increase and increase, not automatically, but season over season over season. His flocks, his herds, he had been working directly with Laban, sharing everything. Laban is changing his wage 10 times. They've been sharing it all. But then all of a sudden, Jacob's flocks keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. What explains it? I think there may be something to this idea. This is just another theory. But I think there may be something to the idea that Jacob knew how to breed animals. That seems to be a given. And it he would make sure that the strongest ones would stay in a confined area and would mate with one another, and he would put down these rods, because when the animals came up to it, much like cattle guards today, they won't step over it because it's uncertain. That's a theory. I think it beats all the other theories that I've read in commentary, so I'm going with that. But the point is, you know, the animals weren't attracted to the rods and then, you know, reproduced after these wood things that are the wood rods that he put down. I think he just confined them and was able to find out. And but he worked at it. He worked really hard at it. And that's what a lot of people miss. And while Laban was content to let him work for him and, "Hey, I'm prospering because I got this guy that's working like a dog for me all these years for these two daughters of mine." It's just hard work. Hard work, opportunity, it pays off. And you know the story about his name being changed later on. So what I've just mentioned, I was going to refer to in Genesis 30, verses 37 through 43, and you can read that. But the United States of America really began one origin point is the Mayflower Compact, of which the 400th anniversary was celebrated just a week or so ago, 1620-2020. And the Pilgrims and the Strangers, as they were called, the Pilgrims are really faithful people, and then the Strangers, as the rest of them, were maybe not as biblically oriented as the original Pilgrims, came over about 100 people in a boat, in a Mayflower, and about half of them died through the first year, either on the voyage or through that first rough winter in Massachusetts. A lot of them stayed on the boat itself. But for those that survived, there are something like 35 million descendants of those 40 or so people that live around the world. That is an amazing statistic that I read when I was researching the Mayflower Compact several weeks ago. Those individuals found out that the land, even though it was harsh and unrelenting, they found that they could have prosperity if they all worked hard. If the first year, I guess the experiment didn't go so well because it was more like, okay, we'll all put everything into the same pot and share of it. And that didn't work at all. But when everybody was given their own parcel of land and said, "Here, go farm it," then along with some help from the Indians who taught them how to grow corn and fish and do some hunting, then they began to prosper. And then that drew other people in. And by the 1600s, there was kind of a wave of migration that came to the shores of this new land. And that was really one of the origin points I think you can look to for America. And it really shows this kind of risk-taking attitude that people had to come over in a small boat, you know, in the winter and land, and then just faced with all the adversity and problems that they have, still be able to make it. Jacob had a relationship with God. We've seen that he tithed. It shows his relationship. Genesis 32 shows his dogged determination to overcome, and his name was changed later in the chapter as he wrestled with the angel of God to Israel, overcomer with God. That kind of overcoming tendency has been what is the trademark of the American psyche. Individuals who are willing to overcome all odds and face all odds. Overcomer, one who prevails with God, it indicates a partnership of man and God. Now let's turn to Genesis chapter 48. Okay, Melvin, something coming up for you now. Oh, Mr. Rhodes. Genesis chapter 48. So we skipped ahead many, many years. Jacob is old. The next to last son, Joseph, is, we can see very clearly, God's hand. He's been sent down to Egypt to preserve the entire nation and then the rest of the world as well, the ancient world around that area of the area of the world at that time. He provides salvation for all of it. And he has two sons. Now, you can look up, and I think it's kind of significant. You can look, Ephraim and Manasseh are mentioned in Bible prophecy many, many times. You can look up. But the two individuals, Ephraim and Manasseh, there's not, I mean, after this chapter in Genesis 49, we almost know nothing of them. But we know a lot about their descendants. And so in Genesis 48, beginning in verse 13, it's time for these national blessings to be passed on. And Jacob says, bring me your boys. And so he's going to go directly to the grandsons. He's going to go directly to his grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so we find out through this that this blessing is conferred upon them in verse 16. The angel who's redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, let my name, that is the name Israel, be named on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude into the midst of the earth. We find it. Ephraim is the younger brother. Grew into a multitude of nations as Jacob or Israel promises in the next few verses. The younger brother who has always acted like the older brother. I think I can say that to Mr. Rhodes and he would not get offended. But the name Israel Jacob is specifically passed on to the sons of Joseph. The descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh were going to be envied by the rest of the world, as it says in verse 20. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. Through the 19th and the 20th centuries and the 21st centuries, these have been the two peoples, and even a little bit before that, Great Britain was great. These are the two peoples throughout history, and it's undeniable as a fact that the world would have been much different without the presence of these two nations. Great Britain kept the world at bay, expanded its empire during the 19th century. Great Britain was the first nation to abolish slavery. That is a commandment-following people. Great Britain was responsible for the dissimulation of the Word of God around the world with the King James Bible. All nations were kind of lifted up by this rising tide of British colonialism. And one thing that, I defer to my friend Melvin, who's an expert on this aspect of history, but he told my brother recently that even, I think it was even up into the 1960s, there were nations that were applying to be a part of the British Commonwealth of Nations. You know, even as kind of the empire is kind of fragmenting and other nations are getting their independence, it conferred special status to be a part of the British Empire, certainly trading rights, and material wealth, but without the British people to set the example for the dissolution of slavery, and then followed by the second nation, the United States, not coincidence, to abolish slavery. It's so unique that had not these two nations been around, the anti-God forces and secular humanism that was being promulgated by the philosophers of the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries would have dominated, and the world would have been ruled only by dictators, despots, horrible, evil men absorbed with power. That's what would have happened. There's no doubt about it. Now, I believe that all nations have something to be proud of, and I know that God has imbued all nations with certain characteristics and talents and abilities, and that is everywhere. And finally, those things are going to be realized during the reign of Jesus Christ. For the first time in history, everybody, all peoples and nations, once they adopt and become a part of Israel. Because Paul said that in Galatians. The Israel of God is all nations following Jesus Christ, Isaiah 2, going up to the throne, learning of his ways, etc., etc. But we're not there. Both the United States and United Kingdom have shown over more than 400 years tenacity toward enemies, courage, inventiveness. Most of the patents in the last, ever since they've had a patent system that is worldwide, most of the patents, probably over 90% of them, have come from the United Kingdom and the United States. Patents for inventions. It shows the inventiveness of Father Israel or Jacob. And from the 19th century until now, they have shed off the rule of kings and dictators, evil, anti-godly governments, and secular philosophy that threatened mankind. But single-handedly, they helped overturn evil and preserve the world so that it would be mostly free today. The descendants of ancient Israel number in the area, when you include all the 12 tribes, in the area of 700 to 800 million people on the face of the earth, a significant portion. All right, we'll get to point number two, and we'll see how far we go after that. Point number two, if you haven't been convinced just by my recitation of history, you should believe the Bible, that there is a special relationship noted in the Bible between God and Jacob or Israel. Okay, ready? We'll do this pretty quickly. Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah 41 and verse 8. There are many. I picked out just four here that show a special relationship, not only at the time of his conversion, which I believe was the time of his wrestle with God, but in Isaiah 41, all through history, up until even now, I submit to you, yes, indeed, even now. Isaiah 41 and verse 8. We read, "But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the descendants of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest regions and said to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and have not cast you away. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who were incensed against you shall be ashamed and disgraced. They shall be as nothing, and those who strive with you shall perish. You shall attack them and not find them. You shall seek them and not find them. Those who contended with you, those who war against you, shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing, for I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. Fear not, you worm of Jacob, you men of Israel, I will help you, says the Lord, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel." Generals of war have taken these promises into battle with them, assured of the victory, not even knowing that they were themselves descendants of the patriarch Jacob or Israel. Turn to Psalm 134. Psalm 134 and verse 4. Wrong chapter, sorry. Let's see. Ba-ba-boom. I've got more Psalms. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what I did there. But let's go to Psalm 147 and cross our fingers. Oh, we're not supposed to do that. Okay. Don't cross your fingers. Psalm 147 and verse 19. He declares his word to Jacob, his statutes and his judgments to Israel. He has not dealt thus with any nation. None. No other peoples have been dealt in the same way with God. And as for his judgments, they have not known them. The judgments, the laws of God, are bound up in the Constitution of the United States. They are, Constitution looks to the Ten Commandments as the foundation of all law. Jacob's descendants did not invoke God and his commandments in their law and weave God's inspiration into everything in the United Kingdom, eventually, and in the Republic of the United States. By accident. It was predetermined by God. Psalm 78 and verse 5. For he has established a testimony in Jacob, and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, that the children who would be born, that may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright, and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Now, this psalm was written long before the ancient 12 tribes had ever gone into any captivities in 721 to 718 BC, or Judah, Benjamin, Levi, and 603 to 585, thereabouts, into captivity in Babylon. God is speaking of the future. He's speaking of thousands of years into the future. And this has been a part of our history. It remains a vital part of many people's lives, yet they are not called. When you look past some of the measurements in which we gauge faith and religion in the nation, which I know church attendance is kind of a big kind of standard by how religious we would look at people, I've kind of looked beyond those kinds of things and some of the research that is traditionally done. Because I believe that, you know, the churches that have evolved through the 20th century, latter part of the 20th century, have not fulfilled the needs of people. So you find a lot of people that believe in God, but they don't attend church anymore. So I think church attendance as a relative measure of people's belief in God is probably worthless by this time because it's failed. We have a whole lot of other alternative types of churches that have popped up in Christianity, and I don't really believe that they necessarily fulfill people's need in seeking God, but you do see a lot of people that profess their belief in God. Now, they are not like you. They don't have your advantage. But, man, I don't. If God hadn't called me, I don't know where I would be religiously speaking. I have no clue. I might be an atheist. I don't know. So when I look at people and the outside of the Church of God today, I really think there's a lot more out there than maybe we even know and believe. I liken America today in some ways to the Samaritans of Christ's day. And I don't have time to go into the whole story, but in John 4, You find the example of Christ meeting this Samaritan woman at the well. And they had kind of religious ideas too. They'd been taught some things, a mixture of truth and error. And when you get past all the locations and all of that and understanding what happened in that discourse, what happened in that interaction with Jesus Christ and the Samaritan woman, he identified her life, and she was convinced that he might be the Messiah. And the story of their encounter is so compelling, and, you know, just the briefest of details are given there. But the upshot is that she goes into the village and she tells everybody what had just happened to her. And then they all came out, and many of them followed him at that point. And we don't know what happened later on in history, but read that with that kind of background. Read it and think about where people are today in history and in the world. And I would kind of say that, yeah, yesterday was a pagan holiday, and a lot of people are so far off base, but that's not their fault. They believe that Christ was born in the wintertime, but they believe in Christ. So I'm not saying belief in Christmas is a good thing, or celebration of Christmas is a good thing, although I did sing to Mr. Walden the other night on Christmas Eve some winter songs, maybe even a few Christmas carols. But anyway, getting beyond that, it was a joke, okay? Oh, by the way, if any of you got a card from my wife, and it had a Christmas stamp, okay, it's just because I bought the stamps on a Sunday at the kiosk in the post office, and I'm too lazy to take the stupid stamps that are printed by the kiosk, and it automatically defaulted to Christmas stamps, okay? All right, so we're not keeping Christmas. It's a stamp. It went on an envelope of a card, and you're mad. Just kidding. That's the reason I had to explain it. Then I had to go to another store and buy some more stamps because a lot of cards went out. All we've got are these. A bunch more Christmas stamps, okay? So it's going to be going on for a while, so just get used to it. Sorry. Jacob and Israel are mentioned, get this, I didn't know this. Jacob and Israel are mentioned in the same verse. These two names, it cements the fact, it's kind of an interesting trivia point, but Jacob and Israel are mentioned in the same verse 87 times in the Bible, thus cementing the idea that God loved Jacob, God chose Jacob, and he changed his name to Israel, which means overcomer with God. And many of those are prophecies of the future. All right, looks like we're at the last point. Are America and the United Kingdom at the crossroads of history? 4 years ago, or 4.5 years ago, I was intrigued by the movement that I saw in the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. And it looks like that finally is coming to fruition. The British peoples, you may have seen stories, or may have seen the newsreels, that's going back to the 50s, sorry, my childhood, that's why I'm losing my hair. The news stories of many Britons assembling peacefully in Trafalgar Square, in London, or various other places, because not only for Brexit 4 years ago, but because they've been kind of upset at their government's reaction to this pandemic. They want the shackles off. Same thing is true here. People in the United States want the shackles off. They want to work. They don't want to rely on the state. They don't want to rely on government. I don't think it's purely coincidental that it happened at the same time that a very unconventional person was chosen as the American president. Somebody who's kind of fed up with the system and the state and the control of government, so on and so forth. So both nations have been fiercely independent throughout their history, and they remain so today. Not everybody. The Brits did not want to be ruled by the laws of other nations from Brussels. They didn't want bureaucrats deciding their fate, and so they threw off the yoke of European domination. They decided to go their own way, make their own agreements, do it on their own, be independent. And there's something that has happened in the United States around the world that you should be cognizant of, in my opinion, from a standpoint of current events. No one knows who is going to be inaugurated as president on January 20th. I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't think you do too, but it's immaterial for the purpose of the message to illustrate what I'm going to bring out. The idea of America, pledge allegiance to the flag, the ideal that has held up, the example that has been to other nations has been phenomenal. Although most of my adult life and in my educated life when I was a kid, we were told how many people hated us and hated the United States, the ugly American traveling abroad and being antagonistic, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe you saw it, maybe you didn't, but before our national election, there were peaceful assemblies and demonstrations of, let's just pick one, thousands of Nigerians marching down streets of their cities with American flags and MAGA hats and Trump flags. Did anybody else see this? Some of you saw it. It was amazing. Recently in Taiwan, Chinese people held rallies for Trump. Are they really holding rallies for Trump? Yeah, they are. But what they're really saluting is the independence and the ideal of what America means, what Great Britain has meant to so many people around the world. In the old city of Jerusalem, this was really crazy. A motorcycle rally through the streets of the old city with flags, American flags, Trump flags, before our election. And shockingly, in our state, before the election, a 97-mile parade on a highway of cars, a caravan for Trump. Are they really celebrating Trump, or are they celebrating what he and what the flag represents, an American ideal, independence? There were massive pre-election rallies in the United States, and the smallest may have been here in Tucson, where the news media said there are a couple hundred people that got together, but other people that we know that went to that rally said there were 10, probably 15,000 people. That was one of the smallest ones that happened. This is not a pro-President Trump speech or anything like that. I'm just saying, what does this mean? What does it mean? It's a clear repudiation of what many, many people see happening in the nation. Many Americans still believe in God, believe in America being a special place, although they really don't know why, like you do. In Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 16, eventually, we know this happens. You can also reference one that I won't have a chance to get to today, but Ezekiel 34, where it talks about the shepherds of Israel, but this is the same thing. In verse, where are we here? In 9, verse 16, the leaders of this people cause them to err, and those who are led by them are destroyed. It is a sad commentary that what we have seen the light shine so brightly on is in the corruption in our government, which is at the highest levels. It's incredible. A lot of people have seen it, and they understand it, and they recognize it. And it's very, very sad. What this presages is there is a time in the future, we don't know how far away, but it's a time of great deception, and that's the last point. A time of great deception. And I'll have time to really go into it. But we end up at Jeremiah 30 and verse 7, which says, Jacob will fall eventually. Jacob will have his time of trouble. We don't know if it's years away or many years away, to be honest with you. We just don't know. One of the greatest blessings conferred on Jacob was the conviction to make his own choice, guided by God, an independence that is the legacy of his progeny. The freedom to make choices based on the evaluation by the individual, using their own minds and their own resources, using their own intelligence. And like Jacob, the United Kingdom and America has prospered in going in that direction, guided by God's blessing and guided by God's direction when they're subject to it. Of course, they haven't always been perfect, as we know. There is a time of Jacob's trouble. Mr. Tannert kind of alluded to that in his sermonette message today. But the God of Jacob is going to save them from that time of trouble as well.